The year before I went to seminary, so many years ago, I worked for the YMCA Camping Services of New York at a little camp near the Delaware Water Gap out east, a place that still has a lot of fond memories for me. And I was remembering this week, as I thought about food, a friend of mine saying to me one day, "I have found this great place to eat." Now, if you're living on three meals of camp food a day, that is music to your ears, right? He said, "It's a wonderful place. Great food, great atmosphere. We should go." And sure enough, that weekend, off we went. And it turned out to be everything that he had promised. It was the restaurant was in an old restored mill, big trees surrounding it. There was a river running by. The wheel of the old mill was still there, the river babbling. It was wonderful food. It was everything that he had promised. You see, having recognized the good himself, he wanted to share that. Well, I was so enthralled with this place that it wasn't 2 weeks before I said to a couple of other friends, "I found this great place to eat." And so I took them. And over the course of the year there, I'm sure I took half a dozen people to eat. By the time I went off to seminary, it was not unusual for me to walk in and I would find people that I had taken who were now bringing somebody else. So I share that little memory from my past with you today because I think it points to one of the assumptions that is made in our gospel lesson today. And that is, there is something very healthy about recognizing the good around us and then wanting others to get in on it. And conversely, there is something unhealthy about not recognizing the good or recognizing it and then wanting to hoard it, wanting to keep it to ourselves. So Jesus begins his story this morning by saying a man decided to give a banquet, a dinner, a luncheon. A man out of his own free will, out of the depths of his generosity, decides to throw a party and he invites many. And I think in those few words, Jesus gives us an incredibly profound image of the Creator, of the one who lies behind it all. You know, I am told that the shortest poem in the English language is all of two words. It's actually a question. I? Why? In other words, why am I here in the first place? Some of you may be aware that Paul Tillich, one of the great theologians of the 20th century, got started on his own philosophical quest when, at the tender age of 14, he heard someone ask, "Why something and not nothing?" In other words, why does anything exist? Which, if you think about it, is an incredibly profound question, and one which science by itself cannot answer, right? Science deals with the hows of our existence, but not the whys. And yet, the way you answer that question colors the way you think about just about everything else. So the scripture's answer to that question, why something and not nothing, is that in the beginning, in that time before time, this one who had life in himself, who came into being we know not how or why, this one, out of sheer generosity, said, "I want others to get in on the ecstasy of my kind of aliveness." And so the scriptures teach us that creation was born out of generosity. God didn't create everything to get something for God's self, but rather to give something of God's self. And so if you and I, If we are created in God's image, that must mean that some of that likeness, some of that tremendous generosity must be inside of us. So today we would call a healthy person one who enjoys who he or she is, and because they enjoy it, they want to share it with others. Though I hardly need to remind you, there are many in our world who don't live by that assumption, right? I mean, we have all read about, we probably know people who have more than they need and never really enjoy it. Maybe somebody came to mind just now. Or they enjoy it themselves, but they've never gotten around to meaningfully share that with anyone else. The fearful person lives her life out of the assumption that there is not enough. There is not enough money or love. And so she clings to everything that she has tenaciously. The faithful person, on the other hand, lives her life out of the assumption that behind it all is the generous one, one who invites each of us not only to take part in his goodness, but to share it with others. So, a man gave a party, and he invited many. Of course, there's more to our story this morning than just the gracious invitation of a generous host. There is also the somewhat shocking response of many of those who were invited, because not just one, but three of those invited come with excuses, or rather they fail to come because of their excuses. I cannot come to the banquet, don't trouble me now. I have married me a wife, I have bought me a cow. I have fields and commitments that cost a pretty sum. Pray hold me excused, I cannot come. Thank you. No reason for standing applause. I still remember that chorus from my days as a youth minister. And it points to a second assumption, I think, in our story this morning, and that is that God's banquet is by invitation only. You remember, the scriptures teach us that God is love. And love, by nature, is not coercive. In other words, God doesn't make anybody do anything. So this gracious host recognizes what every parent of a teenager already knows, and that is that you can do a lot of things in this life, but you cannot make a person freely choose to do even what you know is best for them. For many years, one of my real joys in the ministry was going around to visit some of the college kids from our church. I was on probably every college campus in Michigan. And I loved visiting with them because, you know, they're just at a stage of life where they're thinking in ways that they didn't when they were kids. And sometimes that involves asking questions, even questions about God. Not always, but sometimes. And so I had really interesting conversations in little coffee houses all over the state. One of the questions, which I would hear, you may have thought about this yourself, is, if God is all-powerful, and if God is all-loving, and if God created this world for good, then why is there so much wrong with the world? Woody Allen, you remember, puts this in a more humorous vein. He says, I'm not saying that God doesn't exist. I'm just saying, if he does exist, he's an underachiever. In other words, this God just doesn't do all the things that you would expect a good God to do. So if God is all that God has cracked up to be, these young people would say to me, why is there still hunger? Why is there war? Why does God allow things like racism or apartheid? So it's not my intention this morning to solve the whole problem of evil. I don't want to overpromise, and I did tell Leslie that I would leave it to her to answer that question next week. So I want you to be sure to ask her when she gets back. So I don't want to overpromise. But I do think our gospel lesson has something to say about this basic issue. Because if it was God's intention to let others get in on the ecstasy of his kind of aliveness, then surely he would have to give us some things, right? I mean, first of all, God would have to give us some power. Because part of God's joy was being able to do the things that he wanted to do. And then again, God would have to give us some freedom. There's no indication in the scriptures that God was ever coerced in any way. God acted out of God's own free will. And then God would have to give us some of the wisdom that is so evident in the early chapters of Genesis, so that we would be able to bring that joy to others. Of course, if this was God's intention, that comes with enormous risk, doesn't it? And at the top of that list would be that we would take some of that power and that freedom and that we would use it unwisely in ways that God never intended. And that, of course, is exactly what the scriptures say happened in history. Why is there hunger? It's not because there's not enough food. It's because we lack the collective will. We're seeing that happen right now in Ukraine. Why are there wars? Because people start them. Why is there racism and xenophobia? Because while it is true that perfect love casts out fear, the opposite is also true. Fear can cast out perfect love. Bill Buechner says it beautifully. He says, "The all-powerful God is powerless when we say no." So, a man gave a banquet and invited many, but they all alike began to make excuses. So how can that be? I mean, why would anyone want to turn down an invitation to that kind of thing? Well, I think it's right at that point that this parable, these words on a page, become like a mirror to us. And their story becomes our story. Because did you notice the excuses that people made? You know, I could understand if all of the RSVPs came back from death row, from these evil and horrible people who were intent on hurting or exploiting people. But did you notice? Two of the excuses are about work. And one of them is actually about family. And Jesus seems to be suggesting that we can miss the party for reasons that are not evil at all. So I can miss the party because of my own arrogance, because I just refuse to do the will of God, or I can drift into such a conventional, stay close to shore type of living. I can get so caught up in the everydayness of every day. I can let the concerns of work, and yes, even family, so consume me that I miss the party because I have confused the good with the best. That message came home really clearly to me one day when I read a contemporary parable. It's written by a Lutheran minister, and I came by it quite by accident. It's a little long, but I hope you'll stay with me. It's a story about Herman. Herman closed the front door gently. He took off his coat and hung it in the closet. He unzipped his overshoes, first one and then the other, and bent down to put them in the closet. There was a wild jungle of boots and rubbers confronting him. Muttering under his breath, he began to sort them and arrange them two by two. Then he carefully replaced his own side by side and closed the door gently. It wouldn't close. A Parker jammed in hurriedly was blocking the door. So he methodically rearranged the coats and jackets and then closed the door gently. For one flashing second, he thought to himself, why didn't I just slam that door? Why didn't I just put all my shoes on top of the heap like everybody else? Why do I always close doors gently? But it was only a momentary spasm. One just doesn't do things that way, he said to himself. That would be childish. The house was strangely quiet. The cat meowed plaintively and rubbed against his leg. He stooped over and patted her. Hello, Mrs. Beasley. She followed him to the refrigerator, where he poured some milk in her dish and opened a new can of food. Where is everybody? He asked Mrs. Beasley as he poured the food into the dish. Then he closed the refrigerator door gently. Last minute shopping, I guess. Lorraine was always shopping at the last minute. Well, maybe not always, but a good bit of the time. Probably hot dogs and beans tonight. He was mildly irritated. The bedroom upstairs was a shambles. Lorraine's slacks and blouse were thrown on the bed. Closet doors were flung open. A dress hung askew on a crooked hanger. He sighed and opened his door gently. He hung up his suit, carried his shirt to the clothes hamper in the bathroom. He had to push Tammy's sneakers off the mat, but he hung up her towel. He scooped up her play clothes and crammed them together with his shirt into the hamper. He said to himself, life would be so much easier if people would just take the time to be tidy. It would make my job easier, too, he thought to himself as he ran water into the sink. He had to plan his day. This was Herman's way, the only way he could manage to maintain any semblance of sanity. And then inevitably, someone would come along and disrupt his plans. Suddenly, a great weariness came over him. He leaned and washed his face in the sink. Random thoughts began to flicker through his mind. Will the company expand or relocate? Maybe we'll have to move. Jennings would sure like my job. He's such a cutthroat. Has the washing machine been repaired yet? I wonder how much that was. Jennings has just built a new house. His payments must be pretty steep. No wonder he wants my job. We've got to throw a party soon. Lots of invitations to pay back. Oh, the pledge card from the church. I forgot it had come. That dumb Jennings. He messed up my whole day. I had to drop everything and go to some harebrained meeting about a new idea. He thinks he's the only idea man in the company. He dressed and closed his door gently. He picked up Lorraine's blouse and hung it away. Poor girl. I know she gets fed up with all of her daily routines, breakfast and cooking and getting Tammy off to kindergarten. I know she'd like to get out. This house must be like a prison to her. He closed her closet door gently. He went downstairs. 6 o'clock. Wherever could they be? Then he started to look through the mail. And it was then that he saw the note. Herman, we waited until 5 for you, and then we just had to leave. Please take a cab and join us. You missed Tammy's birthday party last year. Try not to miss it again. Lorraine. Tammy's birthday party. At the restaurant that caters to such things. They'd planned it. He was a little reluctant at first, but okay, the sixth birthday is a milestone. And he could just see Tammy that very morning saying to him, "Daddy, you will be there, won't you?" He'd given her a big hug. He looked at the clock. It was 6:15. And somewhere in Herman's soul, he heard a door slam shut. The kingdom of heaven, so it is said, is like the time when a man received an invitation. You see, even conscientious Hermans can miss the party because we confuse the good with the best. We have been invited, brothers and sisters, to God's wonderful party. Don't let anything make you forget that. Amen.